Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is a special Labor Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Langston Hughes' poem, Brass Spittoons, starts with the jarring line, "Clean the spittoons, boy." The poem grabs and then continues line by line to confront you with the indignities suffered by a black worker in segregated America. And he does suffer those indignities in order to preserve the dignity of his family. Now, in 1945, Hughes recorded the poem, and here it is.
"Clean the spittoons, boy. Detroit, Chicago, Atlantic City, Palm Beach, clean the spittoons. The steam in hotel kitchens and the smoke in hotel lobbies and the slime in hotel spittoons, part of my life. Hey, boy, a nickel, a dime, a dollar, $2 a day. Hey, boy, a nickel, a dime, a dollar, $2, buy shoes for the baby, house rent to pay, gin on Saturday, church on Sunday. My God. Babies and gin and church and women and Sunday all mixed up with dimes and dollars and clean spittoons and house rent to pay. Hey, boy, a bright bowl of brass is beautiful to the Lord. Bright polished brass like the symbols of King David's dancers, like the wine cups of Solomon. Hey, boy, a clean spittoon on the altar of the Lord. A clean, bright spittoon all newly polished. At least I can offer that. Come here, boy."
Langston Hughes in 1945. Now, poets have long been drawn to the challenge of putting the raw physicality, the meaning of work, into verse. For Rina Espaillat, toil brings solace in her poem, Find Work. It begins, "My mother's mother, widowed very young of her first love and of that love's first fruit, moved through her father's farm, her country tongue and country heart anesthetized and mute with labor. So her kind was taught to do. Find work, she would reply, to every grief." Well, this hour we're going to celebrate the poet's power to transmute experience into song. And we're going to listen back to three conversations we've had with some of our favorite poets. And we will start with Rina Espaillat. She is the award-winning author of 13 books, including 11 collections of poetry. She's also the most prominent Spanish translator of New England's own Robert Frost. Now, translation is always difficult, but with Frost, it's even harder. I just listened to Frost reading one of his earlier poems. This is in 1933, and it's called Mowing, where Frost ruminates on a hard day's work in a field, slicing hay with a scythe.
"There was never a sound beside the wood but one, and that was my long scythe whispering to the ground. What was it whispered? I knew not well myself. Perhaps it was something about the heat of the sun, something perhaps about the lack of sound, and that was why it whispered and did not speak. It was no dream of the gift of idle hours or easy gold at the hand of fate or else. Anything more than the truth would have seemed too weak to the earnest love that laid the swaling rose. Not without feeble-pointed spikes of flowers, pale orchises, and scared of bright green snakes. The fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. My long sighs whispered and left the hay to make."
Robert Frost in 1933. Now, balancing in Spanish the structure and sound of Frost's seemingly simple English verse with the deeper meaning embedded in the text, well, it's a delicate dance, Espaillat says. So how does she do it?
"With great difficulty, but also with great excitement and with incredible pleasure."
I spoke with Rina Espaillat at the beginning of last year. She was at her home in Newburyport. And I started by asking her to tell her own story about when she first became interested in poetry.
"Oh, goodness, I was about 4 years old, living in the city of La Vega in the Dominican Republic with my father's mother, who was a poet. She was a lifelong poet, never published, but she used to have gatherings in her house of people who wrote or who recited or who played the piano or the guitar or the violin and so on. And these gatherings of poetry and music would take place. And I fell in love really through my ears with the sound of poetry. So I didn't know exactly what it was the grown-ups were doing, but it sounded like so much fun. I could tell they were playing. And I made up my mind very early in life I wanted to do that, wow, whatever it was.
Now, what was it about the sound that so it charmed a four-year-old?
Well, it sounded like play. It sounded like all those children's games that are played by bouncing a ball. You know, A, my name is Annie. B, my name is Betty. All those things that captivate children early in life. And they do so for a reason, and it's the music of the language. Mm-hmm. It was not so much the what as the how that I really fell in love with. The fact that poetry, even without music, doesn't so much say as sing things.
Right.
And I fell in love with the singing.
Yeah.
And it was not until I was 7 years old, 8 years old, by which time I already was in this country and spoke English, because those early poems, of course, were in Spanish.
That's right.
But by the time I was eight and had learned English and was reading poetry in English, I realized that the what was every bit as important as the how, and that all of it is singing, all of it is music in a way, and that the music carries so much about human life, human experiences, human nature.
Well, Rena, can I just jump in here for a quick second? Because I want to ask you, before we leave those earliest years of yours, I mean, looking back, do you know who you were hearing at the time? I mean, I presume your grandmother's poetry was some of it, but who else were they
well,
singing?
Well, there were poems by my grandmother and poems by her friends also, but also poems by famous Latin American and Spanish poets.
Of course.
And I remember Santos Chocano, for instance, a poem about the horses of the conquistadores and how brave they were and how they ran into battle bravely and conquered the continent and all of that kind of thing. And, of course, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, whom I started hearing very early in life and whom I loved right away.
Yeah. So it's one thing to undergo the struggle of writing your own poetry, of marrying that music and meaning, as you were talking about. And we could spend an hour talking to you about your own body of work. But it's another thing to undertake the struggle to translate someone else's poetry, to do that, again, that marriage of music and meaning that began with someone else's work. So what first inspired you to want to translate poetry?
Well, you know, I think we immigrants, people who come from someplace over there somewhere, whatever the over there is, whatever the other language is, carry with us an awful lot of what we left behind. And I always had the desire to introduce the second half of my family, because my English-speaking friends are the other half of my family. I wanted to introduce to them what I remembered with love from home, home in quotes, of course. I began by translating from Spanish to English so that my husband, for instance, and my English-speaking friends could understand why I loved this stuff so much. But then eventually I realized that the English work had become every bit as much mine as the Spanish. I fell in love very early with Emily Dickinson, with Robert Frost, with Walt Whitman, with poets from all the way back, the very first names in English letters. So I decided that I wanted to make the conversation two-directional.
Yeah. Well, Rena, so I must ask you, though, because it seems to me that of the many media in which we communicate, poetry is really one which is so very much of the language and of the culture in which it was first conceived.
Oh,
right?
You said a mouthful.
I mean, do you ever talk to me about how you do translations? Because, you know, when you talk about music and meaning, is it possible at all to faithfully recreate that music and meaning in another language?
The challenge makes it so much fun. You know, it has remained a game. Poetry is a game, like all the arts. If there is nothing standing in your way and you can just do everything you want without any difficulty, you're not accomplishing anything. I mean, can you imagine a baseball game in which it doesn't matter where the ball goes or what the field is or whether you catch it or not? So the arts work the same way. There are goals, there are rules, and there are difficulties. And part of the fun of what we all do is getting through those difficulties, you know, being in a box when you dance.
Yeah. So you mentioned some of the people that you have translated. I heard Dickinson in there, Proust, Wilbur, and of course you're going to be talking about your translations of Robert Frost.
Right. And the problems, the challenges of translation are very well illustrated by the work of Robert Frost, because he is a difficult poet, not because his language is difficult, but because it's superficially so easy. Because it looks as if it's so easy. It's so much like simple conversation. But of course, under that surface simplicity, there is a great deal of artistry.
Yeah.
A great deal of thought and of calculation. And the trick with him is making the translation sound just the way his originals sound.
Well, so let me just jump in here, because what I'd love to do is do like a little mini masterclass with you right now, because we actually have some tape here of Robert Frost reading one of his own poems, one that you have translated. And this is, of course, possibly one of his most famous poems, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening.
That's right.
Here's Robert Frost himself. We're going to listen to this first, and then we're going to talk to you about how you translated that from the English to Spanish. So Robert Frost reading Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
The masterful Robert Frost is reading his own poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. So, Rena, where do you start then?
Well, the important thing, again, is to tackle the how, because the what would not accomplish the magic that it works without his how. And his how, of course, is the Rubaiyat stanza, which works A, A, B, A, and then B, B, C, B. So I had to imitate his how. I had to get that little horse in there talking to its master, which is a delightful touch. I had to get those snowflakes, which are so light in the poem, so magically swift and flying with such incredible lightness in the poem.
The easy wind and downy flake. Yeah.
That's right. And, of course, I had to get that repetition of the one line at the end, which is what gives the poem its profundity, because the repetition means, this is crucial, this is my point. It's the obligations of life that tie me to the earth, to my poverty, to my difficulties. I cannot afford to take off from life, although in the poem there is a very strong hint of a death wish, a wish for rest from these obligations. And then comes that double line at the end that says, ah, but I'm here to stay because I must, because it's my duty. And the poem in Spanish is called Al detenerse ante un bosque durante una noche nevosa. Este bosque creo saber de quién será. Su casa está en la aldea. No me verá detenerme ante su bosque silencioso, viendo la nieve que al fin lo colmará. Sin duda, mi potrillo está curioso, tan lejos de la granja, al verse ocioso entre este bosque y ese lago helado en el nadir del año tenebroso. Se sacude, el arreo cascabelado tintinea, como un decir, amo, ha cerrado, y no hay otro sonido que el pequeño silbar de viento suave y copo alado. El bosque es bello, oscuro, hondo, halagüeño. pero di mi palabra, y tengo empeño, y hay millas por viajar antes del sueño, y hay millas por viajar antes del sueño.
Beautiful.
Oh. Thank you.
I think I hear what you were saying earlier, that the challenge with Frost is that superficially the language is so simple and straightforward.
Oh, yes, yes. It's really conversational. It's a man talking at random, almost as if he were just thinking of the words as they're coming out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem I had with this poem is that English is so economical. You can get so much into an English line. For instance, whose woods these are, I think I know. Look at how much he has gotten into that whole first line. First, these woods are owned by somebody. Then, I think I know whose they are, but I'm not sure. And then, I'm going to tell you about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's very hard to get into so few lines. I had to add syllables. I tried like mad to squeeze the Spanish into the same number of syllables, but I couldn't do it.
Mm.
I had to add an extra couple of syllables for each line. So that in English it's, whose woods these are, I think I know. Only 8 syllables. But in Spanish it's, este bosque creo saber de quién será. So you heard, because Spanish is not as iambic as English is. It's not as tatum, tatum, tatum as English is. It flows like French or Italian, like all the Romance languages. It's more like a quiet flow of water downstream rather than a marching of boots.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rina, if I may ask, you have been very deservedly lauded for your work in the world of poetry. The Richard Wilbur Award, the T.S. Eliot Prize, the 3 Poetry Society of America Prizes. But I understand that you call the Robert Frost Translation Award Tree in My Window.
Tree at My Window.
Tree at My Window,
Tree
sorry.
At My Window, window tree, my sash is lowered when night comes on. That's the way the poem begins. And it's one of my favorite poems in the world.
And you were one of the first winners of this award in 2004.
I was the first one.
And you call it your private Nobel.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Because to have a poem that is named after my favorite poet in the United States, my favorite estadounidense poet, is a real honor. I feel as if he were in the room with me.
Well, it's so clear that poetry and translating poetry and bringing the worlds together, as you said so beautifully earlier, gives you so much joy. It's given me a great deal of joy just talking about it with you. Rina Espaillat is an author and translator of poetry, short stories, and essays. She's also the founder of the Powwow River Poets, a writing group in Newburyport. We spoke with her in January 2016. Stay with us, because after the break, we'll hear about the complicated life of Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Wallace Stevens. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special Labor Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Before the break, we heard from Newburyport poet Rina Espaillat about the musicality of poetry and translating that poetry into another language, and how the unique sound of poetry drew her in at an early age.
I fell in love really through my ears with the sound of poetry.
Let's listen now to a different kind of poetic musicality, a song of life, loneliness, solitude, and the sublime.
Sounds drift in. The buildings are remembered. The life of the city never lets go, nor do you ever want it to.
It's a song of the contradiction that is the poet Wallace Stevens.
Unwilling that mercy should be a mystery of silence, that any solitude of sense should give you more than their peculiar chords and reverberations clinging to whisper still.
That's Stevens reading his 1952 poem to an old philosopher in Rome. On the outside, Wallace Stevens was the picture of success, a Harvard graduate with a successful legal career and marriage. But on the inside, turbulence. And it was that turbulence that gave rise to Stephen's seeking verse, The Emperor of Ice Cream, The Snowman, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, all meditations on the beauty and terror found in the world.
There is something so deeply attractive, so haunting about what he is saying.
This is Paul Mariani, poet and professor at Boston College. Mariani has written biographies of 5 other major American poets, including William Carlos Williams, Hart Crane, and Robert Lowell. But it is Stevens he has loved most deeply for more than 50 years. And that love courses through every page of Mariani's latest biography, The Whole Harmonium, The Life of Wallace Stevens. We spoke with Paul Mariani last spring when his book first came out, and we began by asking why Wallace Stevens is so important to him.
You read a simple sentence by Stevens, "She sang beyond the genius of the sea," and you realize, wow, wait a minute, what is this about, the genius of the sea? What is this genius of the sea? And then you go back to the Latin and you realize it's the genius loci, or the sense of the spirit of a place. Okay, so I can understand that. But also, from Emerson on, all the transcendentalists in the United States in the 19th, early 20th century, how does nature speak to us? How do we speak to nature? How do we correspond to nature? And in a sense, what Stevens is saying in the very opening line is that somehow we sing, we poets, because we have language, can sing beyond what nature itself can sing. So that's one thing that keeps bringing me back to Stevens.
So the line that you quoted there, "She sang beyond the genius of the sea," is of course from Wallace Stevens' poem, The Idea of Order at Key West. And we actually have a little recording here of Stevens himself reading the first stanza of the poem. So let's listen to that together.
"She sang beyond the genius of the sea. The water never formed to mind or voice, like a body, holy body, fluttering its empty sleeves. And yet, its mimic motion made constant cry, caused constantly a cry that was not ours, although we understood, inhuman, of the veritable ocean."
Now, Paul, when you hear Stevens himself reading that, what is it that you're hearing?
Oh, my gosh. I hear a number of things. On the one hand, you hear the gentleman, the executive from Hartford, in a three-piece suit, standing apart, you know, with armor on his breast there so that you can't penetrate. On the other hand, you hear a very deep human cry calling out for connection. It's that contrast, if you will, the two sides of the human condition, the way we say, "How are you?" And we say, "Oh, I'm fine, thank you." But unless we find somebody to whom we can say, "How are you?" And we can really say, "This is how I am." And this is what Stevens offers, both the edifice as well as a human being, the ghost still crying out 60 years after his death.
Well, at what point in his career did he write this poem? Because in your book, you write that this poem in particular was an announcement that he had once again found his voice.
Yes. Yes. You know, we have the poems that so many people, you know, if you ask them, you know, what poems do you know, The Emperor of Ice Cream, The Snowman, these are all from Harmonium. This is the first volume. And that was published only when he was 44 years old, his first volume. But what happened was he had seen that he had talked himself into a position in which he did not know where to go. And for 10 years, he was silent. Finally, in the early 1930s, he begins to write again. And this is the announcement, The Idea of Order at Key West. What is it that the poet can add to our sense of reality? How does the poet not only speak to us philosophically, but how does the poet touch our very hearts? And, you know, looking at him in the pictures, you'd say, what his boss said when he died. He said, if you had told me he had that he died of a heart attack, I didn't know he had a heart, you know. Well, he did. So that's, I think, what the announcement is.
Well, you know, Paul, this is so interesting because already we've touched upon this several times about the profound contrast between Stevens, the exterior person, and the interior soul, right, that he had. I love the way you said it a little earlier, that even as you heard him read, there is still that tone of the man in the suit, the executive in the suit. And I just wonder if we could talk specifically about sort of that part of his life, because you know, he was born in 1879 in Pennsylvania. As a young man, does go to Harvard, tries his hand at poetry and journalism, but then I think this might come as a surprise to a lot of people who don't know his life in particular. He ends up working for in the insurance industry, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. His father was a lawyer. And so his father said, look, why don't you go into law? Forget this, trying to write poetry. I mean, that's okay as an avocation. And you've tried to be a cub reporter down in New York for the New York Herald. That hasn't worked out. So, look, why don't you go to school? Why don't you go to law school? And he did. He said, look, I'm never going to beg. I'm never going to be one of those artists, say, down in Greenwich Village, for example, okay, which he knew. He knew the whole group who were asking for donations in this. I am going to make it on my own. I'm going to make it as an American executive. And the poetry then, when I've got the time, that will be my secret world.
Hmm. So I'm just curious, as a writer, for a subject like Stevens, whose external life seems rather quotidian, if I could say.
Yes.
How is it that Stevens himself first fell in love with poetry as a young man or found it as a medium, an artistic means of expressing that the profundity that we've discussed he had internally that maybe he didn't express externally?
What happened was he would write poetry. And it was the poetry of the time, okay, because he's trying to learn. And, of course, he doesn't have his own voice yet. So he's imitating the poets at the turn of the century that are being anthologized. The real breakthrough comes in New York City. And it comes as a result of this extraordinary explosion of energy. It's amazing how much the painters, the modern painters, Picasso and Juan Gris and Braque and Duchamp and others, are influencing, because they're looking at what the old paintings were, but then he's looking at this new painting, which explodes on the page, and he says, it's time to change. It's time to make poetry new. And of course, you've got a number of poets, Marianne Moore, and you've got William Carlos Williams and others. And all of this energy is coming up. And he picks it up and he begins to say, this is the direction in which I'm going to go. In The Emperor of Ice Cream, say, or The Snowman, or other poems like that, critics called him a dandy. They got it partly right. He is a dandy in the sense in which the language that he's using, here's a line from The Emperor of Ice Cream. Call the roller of big cigars, the muscular one, and bid him whip in kitchen cups, concupis, and curds. How many of us would say that for making ice cream? You know? And, of course, there's just this deliciousness of the words. You just, even if you don't know what they mean, there's something about that the kitchen cups, concupis, and curds, you know, that you can recite it, repeat it 100 times. Just the delight of language, the difference between saying having to read all kinds of insurance reports, okay, and the language that, you know, that we get from 9 to 5.
Oh, yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then that language, and then, okay, I'm going to take you into another whole new space.
Right.
Just come with me. Yeah.
Right. But I do have to say, and this is something that you also write about in the book, there are other aspects of Stevens. Stevens the misanthrope. Stevens, the patriarch. I mean, he was writing in a time period where perhaps looking at him through the eyes of, you know, two people, you and I in 2016, that are
yes,
a little less, or a little more unsavory. Am I dancing around the truth here?
A little more savory. Yes, no.
Was that a terrible way of putting it?
No, you're absolutely right, Magna. This generation is my grandfather's generation, and in many ways my own father's generation. This is, in fact, what they the way they thought. Some of the anti-racist, even once in a while, an anti-Semitic remark. You know, nobody on the streets of New York escapes, for example, when he's a young man. But you know. But then you hope you grow up. You draw it out of yourself. You know, the connection with other human beings, all human beings, there's something there that they can teach us. Stevens, however, did not. He was not an incredibly social person. So you would find Stevens going up into his room, alone, and opening the window and watching the moonlight, watching the stars, listening to opera. But most of this was all by himself. His wife would be in her, after dinner in her room. He would be in his room, and his daughter would be in somewhere in the middle there studying. Mm-hmm. And that was their life.
On that note, there's something that you write in the book, which I just wanted to read back to you, because, trying to start grapple with this question of, is there a theme or what could be the themes to Stevens's life and his work. You write that there was about the earth a terrifying and awesome sublimity capable of crushing us in an instant. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. There is a sense in which you can look at the world and it can simply overwhelm you. It's that sense of the sublime that Kant talked about, the sense in which the waves are coming towards you. Or you might have a video of someone who's taken a collapse of snow that's crashing, tumbling down towards you, and then it hits the camera and it's over. There's something about nature that can simply overwhelm you. And these things can simply obliterate us, and we're gone. But for us, Stephen says, the thing that can save us, in fact, the only thing Stephen says that can save us, is the human imagination. We have to find a way that no matter what pressure is brought against us, we can find a way to fight against it. That's what you keep finding in Stephen's. What music can I find within me to sustain me as a sandstorm takes over the Whitechapel, if you will, or whatever it is that we live in?
Well, yeah. So what you've just said is the perfect introduction to another piece of tape we have here of Stevens reading his own work. So I just want to listen to it. This is Wallace Stevens reading Final Soliloquy of the Interior Paramour.
Here now we forget each other and ourselves. We feel the obscurity of an order, a whole, a knowledge, that which arranged the rendezvous within its vital boundary in the mind. We say, God and the imagination are one. How high that highest candle lights the dark.
That's an excerpt of Wallace Stevens reading his own work, Final Soliloquy of the Interior Paramour. Paul, earlier you were talking about the sublime, and it occurred to me that another word some people use for the sublime is God. And then you also talked about Stevens and the human imagination. So how does religion figure into all of this?
Yeah, it's that poem just... Okay, I'm sorry. You can... It's so incredible what Stevens is doing there. Here he is at the end of his life. He's in his 70s. He will die at 75. And he sees himself as an old man with a shawl around his shoulders, sitting alone in a room and thinking. And he realizes the thing that I've desired, what I'm looking for, this thing I call the sublime, how do I reach it? The only way I can reach it, really, as a human being, is through my imagination. Whereas he's reached out at the mountains, etc., or the sea, now he's turned inward, and he finds within that God and the imagination finally are one. It's as though what he's been looking for all his life goes by the name one name is God. And then notice what he says. He says, we say. In other words, there's always that modernist sense of, okay, I'm willing to commit to this, but there's this modernist sense of, you know, holding off just a little bit, you know? And yet what happens, even as he holds off, he's flying over towards that mystery. He wants to be absorbed by that mystery.
Mm-hmm. It's clearly a mystery that absorbs you as well.
Yes. Yeah.
May I just ask you, how old are you?
I'm 76.
Okay. Forgive me for being so nosy, at the very beginning of our conversation, you said that for 50 years you'd been reading and thinking about Stevens. And I just wonder now, how has what he means to you changed over time? Because I've heard you just react so powerfully to the little excerpts we played of Stevens reading his own verse.
The things he says, it's the human mind searching for something. Will it ever reach that? We would hope, but perhaps we won't. But it's the desire to move towards that sense of fulfillment or completion. I can't think of another poet, any poet, who touches me as deeply as Stevens does. It's as though he were in this room with me right now.
Paul Mariani is a poet and an English professor at Boston College. He's written biographies of many of the great 20th century American poets, and we spoke with him back in 2016 when his latest biography, The Whole Harmonium, The Life of Wallace Stevens, first came out. It's now available in paperback. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're listening back to conversations with some of our favorite poets. And before the break, we heard about the internal struggle and roiling life of the poet Wallace Stevens through the eyes of Boston College's Paul Mariani. Finally today, another poet who lays bare the biography of his own soul openly and publicly, voicing what it means to him to live as an African-American man in the United States today.
All of my black friends were raised with the same message, the talk given to us when we became old enough to be mistaken for a nail ready to be hammered to the ground, when people made our melanin synonymous with something to be feared.
That's Clint Smith, the 2014 National Poetry Slam winner, in a viral TED Talk from a couple of years ago. Smith is an award-winning teacher, a New Orleans native, and a PhD candidate at Harvard. He's also the author of a collection of poems called Counting Descent.
I want to live in a world where my son will not be presumed guilty the moment he is born. And I refuse to accept that we can't build this world into something new. Some place where a child's name doesn't have to be written on a t-shirt or a tombstone, where the value of someone's life isn't determined by anything other than the fact that they had lungs. A place where every single one of us can breathe.
We spoke with Clint Smith last December when his collection Counting Descent first came out, and we began with the reading of a poem from the collection. The poem's called For the Taxicabs That Pass Me in Harvard Square.
For the taxicabs that pass me in Harvard Square. When the first cab passes you, wonder if you've been rendered an autumn tree, derelict monument amid the white noise of Massachusetts Avenue. When the second cab passes you, pull off your hood and hat, even though the ice is fresh. You don't want to be mistaken for a shadow, a threat. When the third cab passes you, pull out your Ivy League ID and wave it in your hand like the curb was a desert island. When the fourth cab passes you, think of fifth grade, Mrs. Caperson holding all the boys in for recess to tell us if we don't get tattoos, grow out our hair, pierce our ears, or sag our pants, everything will be all right. When the fifth cab passes, you know everything is not all right. When the sixth cab passes you, imagine yourself a puddle, existing as both transparency and filth, something that won't be there by the afternoon. When the seventh cab passes you, remember how Grandma said this is how long it took for the good Lord to build the world.
Is that poetry? Is it verse? Or is it biography?
It's a little bit of both. I think this poem is certainly a reflection of a personal experience that I've had, having been here at Harvard University for the past 3 years. And for me, what was really important to do in this collection was sort of disabuse people of the sort of narrow notions of what racism is or what racism looks like to them. And that, you know, I've had people say to me, as a result of me being a doctoral student at Harvard or being affiliated with certain institutions or places, that I have somehow transcended racism. But what this book is attempting to wrestle with is this sort of daily minutia of how racism manifests itself, and that is not simply a sort of interpersonal violence, physical or verbal, that gets exacted on someone, but is instead the sort of like daily, pernicious, nuanced manifestations of a different sort of violence that like continuously imposes itself on you.
Yeah. When is it that you found poetry as one of the ways that you could give voice to that experience so powerfully?
Yeah, well, I have been writing for some time. The first time that I remember reading a poem out loud was when I was in fifth grade. I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and there was a camp that took public school students from the school into the woods for like 3 days, and we would often go into these places that they call our magic spots. So if you can imagine like a group of young kids being told to run off into the woods to their magic spot to go write, it was quite the scene for a bunch of fifth graders. And we would go and we would, you know, write in diaries or write in journals. And I wrote a poem that I remember now, and it was, "An animal is a thing that lives and breathes. We must not mess with its needs. If we do, we'll pay the price with a future world not so nice." And I came back and I read that at dinner time, and all the girls were like, "Oh my gosh, you're so good. That's amazing." And I was like, "This is it. Poetry's the way to go." But no, truly. So I've been writing for a while, yeah. But it wasn't until about 2008, 2009 that I began taking it more seriously, and that I found a sort of access point to literature in a way that had previously been missing. And I found that when I was living in New York City during the summer and was introduced to the spoken word poetry community. And for me, it was this remarkable sort of affirmation of voice.
Yeah.
And it was this opportunity to recognize that I didn't have to acquiesce to sort of like dominant paradigms and notions of what is legitimate art or what is legitimate literature, and that my story and my voice and the sort of idiosyncrasies of my voice and the voices of those around me could exist on the page and could exist out in the world.
Right. So what is legitimate art? What is legitimate literature or even protest? Because, I mean, the epigraph that you have here at the beginning of the book from Ralph Ellison, mm-hmm. A quotation from him saying, "I recognize no dichotomy between art and protest."
Right. I think it's a false choice. I mean, I think that oftentimes we, you know, what we're sort of inundated with when we're young is that one's politics should not be embedded necessarily in their art, and that imbuing one's politics into their art compromises the artistic integrity of the work, and that you should instead be focusing singularly on the aesthetic, singularly on the nature of the craft. But what I really appreciate about Ellison, and why that's the first thing you see when you open my book, is that he rejects this sort of like false compartmentalization. He rejects the idea that one's full self should not be a part of the work that they create and put out into the world.
Yeah. So, I mean, because what I find remarkable about this collection is that every one of the poems is obviously very politically aware, but it's done through this lens of, you've got a lot of dialogues going in the poems. It's like dialogues with the political world, dialogues with how you find yourself as a black man in America today, dialogues with young black boys, whether they be, the boy that you were in your memory or young black boys today. I mean, there's a whole series of poems in here titled, "What the Window Said to the Black Boy," "What the Ocean Said to the Black Boy." What's the other one? There's a bunch of other ones. What the Cathedral Said to the Black Boy. Can you tell us about, like, these series of poems? They're sort of sprinkled through.
Yeah, so I wrote probably a dozen of those poems. And part of what I've been thinking about a lot over the course of the past few years is this idea of the pedagogy of Black parenting and the ways in which Black parents are forced to make decisions about how they raise their children. And so I'm very fortunate. I grew up in a very mixed race, mixed income community. I had Black friends, white friends, Asian friends. It was great. It was like the Disney Channel. You know, we were riding bikes with theme music playing in the background, our hair blowing in the wind. And my parents would always say to me, we really appreciate that you have such a diverse group of friends. It's wonderful. It's why we moved to this neighborhood. It's why we moved to this city. But what you have to understand is that the implications for the decisions that you make might be very different for you than they are for your other friends. And when you're a child, you don't really understand that. It's sort of a youthful abstraction that, like, you hopping over a fence at nighttime might be different, might have different implications than it would for your friend Tommy.
Yeah, or playing with a super soaker in a parking lot. In one of your poems.
Certainly.
Yeah.
And I think that, so part of what I was thinking a lot about was, what do those conversations look like? What sort of toll does that take, not only on the child, but on the parent, to have to continuously sort of compromise the childhood of the person that you're raising in an effort to make sure that they stay safe? And so I was sort of thinking about, as an artistic endeavor, what would that look like to imagine a series of inanimate objects or non-human things engaging in that same sort of discourse with young Black boys? What would they say? What would the window say? What would the ocean say? What would the cathedral say? Would they provide warning? Would they provide solace? Would they provide advice?
Well, could you read one of those? I mean, how about what the ocean said to the Black boy?
What the ocean said to the Black boy. You know how to swim, boy? I know you can float. Felt you bobbing along my surface before you even knew you could. They say you just a conflagration of bad intentions, boy. They use me to put you out. Don't want you burning this place down. Again. They see a little too much Lovature in you. A little too much Turner. A little too much of what they already had enough of. What you see when you look at me? You know how many of y'all I swallowed? You just a drop of ink on this canvas, boy. They call me blue because they don't understand how the sky work. They call you Black because they don't understand how God work.
There's so much that you do. We're not going to be able to cover it all in the time that we have. But I want to ask you a little bit about why one of the dialogues, one of the recurrent dialogues I see in this book is also you grappling with your own family's history. There are a couple of poems in there about that, about your own lineage.
Certainly. Yeah. And I think hence the title of the book is counting descent, yeah. Sort of trying to make sense of one's lineage. And I think the book is thinking about lineage in both a macro and micro level context. So on a sort of macro context, what does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to be from Louisiana? What does it mean to be from New Orleans? And as a sort of micro context, what does it mean to be my grandmother's grandson? What does it mean to be my father's son? What does it mean to be someone's brother, someone's partner, someone's friend, someone's teacher? And how do each of those things shape how I understand who I am in the broader context of the world? And how does that sort of those sort of parallel senses of lineage shape what is this sort of like marathon of cognitive dissonance that it is to grow up as a young Black person in this country, and wrestling with that sort of constant duality of being a part of a family and a lineage in which you are celebrated and loved and affirmed, and then constantly going out into a world in which you are rendered a caricature of fear. And how does one hold both of those at once?
So tell me, I mean, the marathon of cognitive dissonance, how did you wrestle with that?
I think I'm still wrestling with it. I think it's not something that's ever finished necessarily. I mean, I think that part of, you know, this poetry collection was written largely in response to the death of Mike Brown in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And when I first began writing this, I think I was writing in an effort to name and to humanize those who were experiencing violence at the hands of the state and those who were experiencing sort of violence more broadly, and the way, the pernicious, violent ways that racism manifests itself. But about a year into writing this collection, I realized that I was sort of singularly writing about Black people being killed. And that struck me because that is not all that represents the sort of diasporic experience. Like, we are more than that which seeks to kill us. And I wanted to write into the celebration. I wanted to write into the joy. I wanted to write into the laughter, whether it's, you know, my parents dancing in the kitchen, or what it means to fall in love, and all these different things that shape who I am and how I understand the world that aren't shaped by violence.
Cambridge-based poet Clint Smith. We spoke with him when his collection of poems, Counting Descent, first came out last year. You can find videos of his TED Talks and more of his poetry at our website, radioboston.org. Thanks so much for joining us today on this special edition. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.